Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to give you folks an update of some of the work that's going on in the Rice community. And acknowledging my colleagues, George Isinga, Wingui Yan, which are colleagues with me at the Dell Bumper Center, Dr. Ali and Zongbu Yan are with the University of Arkansas, and Susan McCooch with the Cornell University. So as many of you know, that rice is a staple food crop that feeds half the world. And as this graph shows, consumption is outstripping production at a global level. And of course, many of the people that rely on rice as a staple food crop are in some of the poorest nations of the world. And so it definitely is critical that we utilize all the resources that we have to try to increase rice yields. This is where rice is produced in the United States. We have two major regions, the Mid-South area and in California. And the gene pools in these two different areas are quite different, and that's largely driven by the difference in climate, the Mid-South region being a semi-tropical environment and California being a more temperate environment. Even though the amount of rice produced, or the acreage in rice in the United States, is quite small compared to many other countries in the world, half of what we do produce is exported, and that provides 10 to 15% of the rice that's in world trade. So many of these nations which rely upon rice as their staple food crop, of course, they can't export it, they have to import. And a number of those countries, the people are consuming maybe 70% of their calories are coming from rice. So it's definitely critical that the United States continues to, make our contributions towards improving global food security. So if we looked at the rice production in the United States versus the acreage, the blue line is the production amount in millions of hundredweights, and the red line is the acreage. And so what we see is that, yields have been, or productivity has been high. At the end there you see where the acreage is actually decreasing, but our yields are going up. So that's great, and that's due to not only genetics, of course, but also a number of other reasons, as we've mentioned earlier today, in terms of agronomy and cultivation. But we need to definitely be able to continue to keep those yields going up for the reasons I've mentioned already. So if we wanted to look at, what sort of yield increases, have actually come from the breeding aspect, this is a study that we conducted just looking at the varieties that were developed out of the USDA rice breeding program in Texas, which was first initiated by Hank Beachel, who won one of the World Food Prize. The second breeder was Charlie Bollick, who's in the ARS Hall of Fame. And so this is really kind of looking at the results of their years of research. And so over about 50 years, we see a dramatic increase in yields. The broken line at the top is the response due to when these cultivars are being grown under higher inputs, nitrogen inputs, and the bottom line under lower inputs. And so what this shows is the varieties that were developed over this half century period were higher yielding and also responsive to the nitrogen fertilizer inputs. And of course, a lot of that was due to because we introgressed the semi-dwarfing gene, reducing the height of the plant by about 2 feet, and we reduced the days to maturity by about 2 weeks. So there's a huge changes in the plant architecture, which also resulted in increased yields. And I'll just mention that semi-dwarfing gene was a gene that was introgressed from an Asian source into U.S. materials. And so here's kind of a look at the pedigree of the rice grown in the southern United States. At the top are the few progenitor lines that were the basis for our pedigree. And what it shows, and so this is looking at about 100 years of rice in the United States, with the older varieties at the top and the newer ones at the bottom. And so what this shows is that really there's only less than 30 cultivars that were served as the basis for the U.S. rice breeding program. And breeders over the years have tried to incorporate other sources of germplasm, but those really have been not very successful, and that's largely because they've always run into a constraint in terms of grain quality. The United States has traditionally had some of the highest grain quality in the world. That has allowed us to have an export market where we've actually received premiums in the marketplace because of that grain quality. Over the last 20 years, we've seen where countries like Vietnam have dramatically improved their grain quality, so now we no longer have that premium. But anyway, my point is that in the past, the efforts at trying to bring in diverse germplasm in the breeding programs has really had limited success. And we now have the capability of looking at our materials, of course, with a variety of different markers. And this is looking at some 400 cultivars, probably about 300 of those are elite germplasm from the U.S., southern U.S. breeders in the last few years. And these were evaluated with a SNP chip using over 1,500 markers. And what we see here is actually that the materials from each of the different southern breeding programs, Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, that the materials all essentially kind of clump together, which indicates that the breeding programs are not even broadening their materials out into other U.S. breeding program materials. They're becoming more and more narrow. So in comes the USDA World Collection of Rice. This is a collection that began back in 1904. We have just over 18,000 accessions coming from 110 different countries. And one of our jobs in our Stuttgart location is Dr. Yan's job is to evaluate this material for its various characteristics and also, of course, regenerate that material so that it can go through the process of being supplied to any interested parties. But of course, if you wanted to have a breeder say, okay, go out here and find something good and bring that into your breeding program, they're going, I don't see anything. And so it's a long process, of course. And so what we've tried to do is Dr. Yan and Harold Bachman developed what they call a core collection, which is 10% of the whole collection. And we've done studies which have shown that the diversity in the core collection is representative of the whole collection. So still, I mean, that's an improvement of looking at, you know, just 1,700 lines, not 18,000. But then what we've gone is a step further, and we've developed a mini core, which is 1% of the whole collection, and have proven that this mini core has the same sort of degree of diversity as the whole collection. So now we have a set of materials that we can evaluate effectively and kind of get a better handle of what the genetic diversity is and how to utilize that. And so we're in the process now of genotyping these materials, and we're now at a point where we have 155 markers on the mini core, and these are, you know, dispersed throughout the genome. And then our next step is through various studies looking at association mapping, identifying traits and where they're located on the genome in this mini core. This is a study that was looking at the core collection was the 1,700 lines, which were genotyped with 72 microsatellite markers. And this just shows the diversity throughout where these materials came from and the genetic diversity they have. So the warmer the colors, the more the genetic diversity. So as I mentioned before, the material in the U.S. Breeding pool is very narrow. And so if a breeder was interested in trying to diversify it, this shows that where those hot spots of diversity are in terms of gene pools. We can also use these markers to, of course, evaluate this mini core collection. And what we find is the structure of this material breaks out into two major groups. One would be the Japonica versus what we'd call the indica materials, two major groups, and then within that there's subgroups. So within the japonicas, we have the tropical japonicas, which is where the majority of the southern U.S. rice breeding materials come from, the temperate japonicas, which would be more like the California or the medium grains, aromatics, and then on this side we have the indicas and the ouse, which in the U.S. materials are not really utilized that much. So having this sort of structure information is relevant to breeders because, one, even if you're just interested in working within the tropical japonicas, you can really identify what the diversity is within that material and what would be the best source of materials to broaden your own breeding materials within just the tropical japonicas. Likewise, if you're interested in making really wide crosses, you can use this type of information to identify what would be the best source. And what breeders have found in the world is that if you make crosses between japonicas and indicas, because they are so distantly related, there is a fair amount of sterility. And so for a breeding program, that means you have to go through back crosses or other means to try to get greater fertility. But on the other hand, that source of sterility has become useful, as we're now seeing that hybrids are being developed in rice. And so actually in China, there's probably 60% of the acreage is in hybrids at this point, and they're utilizing male sterility systems. In the United States, there's been a dramatic change in the last 10 years. We've gone from what was just always public cultivars to at this point, probably 30% of the acreage is in hybrids, and probably another 40%, 30 to 40% is in intellectual property protected materials. So anyway, having this sort of genetic structure information will be helpful in how to develop strategies to broaden one's breeding program. And this is another study where we've just broadened it. So that was this is a different diversity panel in a project with Cornell University and NSF funded, where we looked at 400 diverse cultivars, and we still see this same sort of structure of the five different major subpopulations. But again, just showing that the greater these markers can be used to help us to identify the diversity and how to utilize it. So once we have that sort of information, we can go back into our core collection, and we've broken it out into these five different subgroups and identify what proportion of this core collection is in these groups. About 35% is in indica, 27, 24 in the japonicas, and then the aus, which are related to the indicas, another 10%. But what's interesting here is to show that the indica material is very rich in terms of the numbers of alleles per locus and the number of private alleles, which means alleles which are unique to that subpopulation. So looking at the indica material and the aus, which is related to indica, but it's more for the drought-tolerant regions, this just demonstrates how rich these gene pools are in terms of allelic diversity and can be really used to help improve our japonicas. Sometimes you're just kind of lucky, and so Dr. Yan was able to identify one of these lines in this collection, which came from China. He put it through a mutation breeding program and has developed and released a new variety called Rondo. And so this is an indica cultivar, which compared to Kokodri, which is a very widely grown cultivar in the southeast, in the south mid-south area. And you can see it had yield of 9,100 kilograms per hectare, which is approaching the yield of this hybrid, which is out there at 9,800 kilograms per hectare. Now, one of the problems with it is it tends to be tall and late and lodging and has the poor milling quality. So even though we're able to mine this germplasm collection and identify materials like this, we still have some work to do. And what we're, of course, hoping is that having these genetic markers will help us overcome some of these other problems. And I will just say that this cultivar has a special cooking quality, and it is now being looked at for the parboiling industry in particular. So in addition to just identifying materials that are in the collection, of course, there's the next step is making crosses with those materials. And this is a summary of just some work from Dr. Zhang Buyan at University of Arkansas. And he's made a number of crosses between different accessions, either from China or from Italy in the Philippines, crossing those with several different U.S. parents. And here's the number of lines that were being evaluated in this replicated yield trial this past year. And so this just shows the average of that cross versus the U.S. parent yield. And so we're seeing in these crosses, 7 to 15% yield increase over these U.S. parents. Again, just showing the potential of some of these materials, these accessions from our collection. And this is just looking at a few of those same lines that were, we had enough seed to go into a multi-location test this past year. And so this is the percent yield compared to Cocodry. So 100 would be the same as Cocodry, this very prominent variety grown in the South. And so it just shows that we have a number of these lines that are having excellent yield potential. This line here, GP2, is from China. You can see it's about a 30% yield improvement based compared to Cocodry. So in addition to just working with materials that are in the Oryza sativa species, there's also an approach to start looking at the wild species and how they might be used in a breeding program. And this is part of this NSF project with Cornell. This is looking at about 300 different wild species from the Rufopogon and Navarra species, again being clustered with a SNP chip marker. And then we have in here a few lines that were sativas just to mark what the different groups were. And so the point being that there's wild species that are that coincide in the same subpopulations as our sativas. And then there's also materials that don't seem to be closely related to that at all. So using this type of information, one can identify materials to explore more in depth. And so that's what Georgia Eisenig is doing. And she's, in this project, has identified three different wild species, come from different regions of the world. They also are from these different subgroups. And you can see they have very different plant phenotypes. And these are being crossed to Cybonnet, which is one of our southern U.S. cultivars, IR64, which is a mega variety that's grown throughout Asia, and developing these chromosome segment substitution lines with the idea of looking at least 8 different integrations per chromosome of the Rufopogon wild species into the sativa background. And so this type of set of materials would then be able to help us to identify genes located that are on these different chromosomal regions that were introduced by the wild species. And we know that this is going to be probably a promising approach because we've already done some of this work. And this is where we've made crosses with a Rufopogon wild species with a Jefferson, which is a cultivar that I developed through a back crossing program that was initiated at CIAT by Cesar Martinez. We developed a whole series of lines that have different integrations on different chromosomes, 1, 2, 3, 6, 8, and 9. And so this is a yield trial that was conducted over 8 different environments. That was 4 locations in 2 years. And so here we have the yield of Jefferson, which was released back in 2000. And what this shows is these integration lines have significantly higher yield potential compared to its parent. And in fact, these lines, when they're compared to these two new, more recently released cultivars, Cocodry and Trinas, are much closer in yield potential. So this just shows that this wild species can really move up the yield potential of the original recurrent parent. And so what we did is we took a couple of these lines and moved them into our uniform regional rice nursery, which is conducted in 5 different states, being compared with breeding lines from all the southern U.S. programs. And so these are the two integration lines. And you can see that this one in particular had, this is 94 kilograms per hectare yield compared to Cocodry. And these are some of the more recent releases from the southern programs. But what we want to compare this to is Presidio, which is actually a derivative of Jefferson. Jefferson is no longer included in this test, but you can see even this improved version of Jefferson, that this one integration line in particular has significantly higher yield potential. So we're very encouraged, and we're going forward with the germplasm release on these, and this just demonstrates the value of mining these wild germplasm resources. One direction. So in conclusion, I think we've demonstrated that the NSGC collection of rice is a very rich source for improving rice yields. And we're now using this genetic marker technology to help overcome some of the previous barriers that breeders had in trying to utilize this material. We have markers that are closely linked to grain quality traits, for example, and will allow us either through back crossing programs or other means to make sure to have that problem solved. It's also being useful in helping us to better understand the rice population substructure and the materials in our collection. And having that substructure understanding will give us the breeders guidance on how to make the most diverse sativa crosses to improve their programs. In addition, this indica germplasm in particular is extremely rich in diverse alleles that can be used to improve our tropical japonica germplasm. We've already demonstrated that there's improvements in yield, and we're using these materials in developing male sterile lines that could be used in hybrids in the future. We're also using marker-assisted selection to really mine the genes that are in our wild species, also trying to improve our the yield potential of our U.S. cultivars. So with that, I'll close and appreciate your attention this morning. Thank you.
We do have time for questions. Are there questions?
Yes.
You mentioned that, like, I think you said 50% of the acreage that is now being planted in Texas or in some places, it's intellectually protected, it's material that, does that mean that those cultivars are being released from the public sector, or they are under control of private seed companies?
So the question was about the percentage of the acreage that's under intellectually protected varieties in the U.S. And so those are actually herbicide-resistant rice varieties. The source of the resistance came from a mutation that was identified in a public program. But because it's resistant to a specific set of chemicals, there's a partnership, you know, between the public sector and the chemical company, and then a third party, which is actually the one that produces and distributes the seed. So it's one of these partnerships. But the point being, you know, that sort of material is its own gene pool is not, you know, widely distributed and utilized by other folks.
Would those partnerships become more common, and do you think, in your opinion, in the rice world?
So the question is, will those sort of public-private partnerships become more common? I think definitely they will be, and that the United the public breeders, obviously their role has dramatically changed in the last 20 years because of the private interest. And now with the interest in hybrids coming on, we actually, you know, see that, you know, just what is the role of the public sector. And so there's a bit of conflict going on about just, you know, describing what that role is. We've seen in other crops how it's germplasm development and those sort of things, which is definitely necessary. But we actually have Southern U.S. breeders are coming together in a consortium to develop hybrids themselves. So I'm sure that's to a service of the rice industry. All right, thank you very much for your time.